And they regard Formosa as part of China. And so it's perfectly natural they should want to go in there. And I think also one can attribute the movement in Tibet to the idea of taking over another area which they regard as part of China, and also perhaps to get in there before the Soviets do.
That intrigues me very much, Quincy, above all. That the Soviets, having been the traditional enemy and invader of China for 300 years or more from the north, and having control of the great Xinjiang province today, is being offset by this outflanking movement of the Chinese communists into Tibet.
Yes, the diplomacy of the 19th century figured around Tibet to a considerable extent. The British, while in India, were always afraid that Russia might get it, and the Russians were afraid the British might get it, so it was a sort of a neutralized zone. And the Chinese always claimed it was Chinese territory, and at various times they sought to penetrate it and to exercise an actual administration.
Do you think that it's possible that the aggressiveness of the Mao Zedong regime has anything to do with the increasing power and productivity of Japan? Are they looking to that? Are they attempting to set up a situation in which, in general negotiations, they might be able to cancel out the threat of increasing power in Japan?
Well, of course, they don't like to have a ring of American bases on the coast of China. They don't like to have us in Japan. They don't like us. They don't like Formosa to be out of their hands. The Philippines, they would doubtless like to have us on the other side of the moat, that is, the other side of the Pacific Ocean. But I can't believe that they're contemplating a war in which they would have to win an outright victory over the United States to get us out in order to achieve any such objectives.
Well, it seems to me we ought to relate these objectives of the communist China up with Russia for a moment.
Well, before we actually got down to that, there's one point, if you will allow me, which we took up en route, but I think didn't examine quite as realistically as I would like, and I know that you're both authorities on this subject. I ask myself, what would Mao lose if he were in a war with the United States? If you're thinking of it from the standpoint of the deterrent effect on a person's mind, even if he's belligerent, would I be right in saying this, that you could hold Korea at that the narrow neckline of Korea with not too great an expenditure of American manpower for a long time, and though we would sustain losses, it would be quite a drain on him. Two, he would lose his industrial centers in Manchuria. Three, I presume you could, without the use of the atomic bomb, really destroy the great cities of the mainland together with a certain propaganda. These things would go together. And though you could not occupy China in the long run, nevertheless, you could cause a really serious disintegration of the economy and the political institutions of the regime, say for 2 or 3 or 4 years.
That's right, and those losses would be so tremendous, I can't think that Mao, who has plans of building up the industry of China, can think of a war which would destroy those. The only gain he would get, it seems to me, would be a possible cementing of opinion in China against the United States. Doubtless after such a war, all the Chinese would hate the United States, and if Mao wants that, the expense of any economic prosperity for a couple of generations, then he might contemplate. I don't believe he does.
Therefore, Mao has something that we can give him, that's immunity from war. He's got something to lose. If he's got something to lose, he's got something that he can ask us for. And therefore, this may lead us, if he's thinking of his own interests only, China alone, there may be some hope that we won't get ourselves involved in the nightmare. But I interrupted you, Earl, and I'm terribly sorry. You wanted to introduce this question
to
the Soviet.
Relate this up with Russian policy, right? Do you have any ideas on what Russian policy really is in regard to the party?
Well, it seems to me that the China, Mao, has no interest in getting into war with the United States, but I can easily see why the Kremlin might like to see Mao in war with the United States. It has appeared that the Kremlin has a definite policy of expanding through satellites, avoiding direct participation in the war, which might make Moscow and the big cities of Russia vulnerable to bombing attack, but getting as much expansion through satellites, bothering the United States and the United Nations, keeping these wars going on the fringes, and particularly, in this case, getting the United States and the United Nations in force in the Far East, absorbing all their forces in the vast areas and population of China, which would mean that they couldn't give as much attention to Western Europe, and that would then become vulnerable.
In other words, what the Russians really want is to get the United States involved in a long war in the Far East. If we take the bait and allow ourselves to get involved, we'll be doing just exactly what the Kremlin wants us to do.
I agree with that.
Well, you know that if you were to take the voices that we've heard in this country in recent weeks on the right wing of politics, though they appear discordant, since they sing individually and not in a choir, nevertheless, if you consider, take them all together, the discordant voices, they make a surprising harmony. And that is to say that you would prefer, as it were, the MacArthur solution of putting America's interests and power in the Far East and neglecting the West, and subordinating the Marshall policy of keeping our eye on the Western target. That's how it has seemed to me.
I can't see how that would be good American policy. I can see how that would be very good Soviet policy. I can't imagine anything the Soviets would like better than to see us bogged down in a war in that area. What you say indicates what is so often true, that the extreme right and extreme left come together. They have a common policy, and I think we have that illustrated in this on this occasion.
Well, we seem pretty well agreed, then, that we shouldn't get ourselves bogged down in a war in China, and hence lose sight of the area which is our chief objective, and that is strengthening Europe and being in a strong position there. In that case, what sort of a policy should we pursue toward the Far East?
Well, I think we should contemplate the possibilities of negotiation. We shouldn't, and you can't negotiate unless we recognize. Consequently, we should get into relations with the Mao government of China, find out precisely what they're after, and after we have done that, see whether it isn't possible to negotiate. I believe our policy should be defense without provocation and conciliation without appeasement. And we've got to ask ourselves whether the non-recognition of the Mao government is an act of provocation. Is it required by defense? And then we've got to ask ourselves what concessions can we make in regard to North Korea, in regard to Formosa. Be appeasement, but would be a fair conciliation.
Well, for my part, though, I would have some qualms, and nevertheless, taking the whole situation into account, I would say that the de facto government of China should be recognized and admitted into the United Nations. Pritchard, do you see that there would be disadvantages, moral and otherwise, offsetting that?
No, I really do not. I think that's the realistic approach to the matter. That we should accept the fact that the Chinese communists are in control in China and try to deal with them and talk with them. By doing so, we will have a better chance in the long run to perhaps wean them away from Russia and make possible the development of a Titoism in China. We've already indicated that historically enmity between Russia and China is a thing which really exists, and it can reappear again. As a matter of fact, Russia has positions in Manchuria today which is a limitation upon Chinese control there. And given the satisfactory circumstances, those conflicts are likely to develop again.
We have to remember that Mao, like Tito, is the only head of a communist state or a communist government which won his position by his own activity. It's very different from the cases of Poland and Czechoslovakia and the other satellites. And I think that suggests that that he will think of China, not merely think of the Kremlin in any negotiations he might enter into.
I think that's right. The problem we have to face is one of our national interests. And it seems to me, altogether, we will suit our national interests best by dealing realistically with the situation, trying to negotiate with the Chinese, work out some sort of a settlement here in regard to Korea, which they will accept. I would go to the point of agreeing, if necessary, to let them take part in a committee which will set up a government in Korea.
Well, I think that we've got to this particular point, and I think perhaps I could speak for the three of us. We want to talk peace with China. We want peace. If we are forced into a war and attacked, we can't do anything other than to defend ourselves. But we would not want that. We have no interests which bring us into a violent conflict with China, and they, we think, have none that bring them into a violent conflict with us. We can solve the Korean question. We can solve the Yalu River question. We can solve the Formosa question. We can solve the United Nations recognition question with China around a council table if they are interested in Chinese interests rather than ideologically fanatical in the interests of some idea or some other power.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago roundtable on the Chinese nightmare were Herman Feiner, political scientist, Quincy Wright, expert on international law, and Earl Pritchard, historian, all of the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable discussion contains the full text of the discussion and special supplementary materials to help you understand the relations between China and the Western nations. The pamphlet also contains letters from listeners, special reading lists, and questions for you and your friends to discuss. This week's pamphlet on the Chinese nightmare is available for 10 cents in coin. We wish also to announce that printed copies of last week's roundtable on poetry by T.S. Eliot are now available and contain the selections of his own poetry as they were read and commented upon by Mr. T.S. Eliot. Individual copies of this pamphlet are also only 10 cents in coin. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copies of the roundtable pamphlets. A four-year subscription to the roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with last Sunday's program on poetry by T.S. Eliot. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the roundtable discusses the Bible and new discoveries of ancient manuscripts in a program titled The Dead Sea Scrolls. May we invite you to join the new Roundtable Home Study course in Human Rights, especially prepared for you to do in your own home. You may enroll and begin at any time this four-lesson course in Human Rights. Write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the brochure describing the course and telling you how you may register. Today's Roundtable originated in the Mitchell Tower studios of the University of Chicago. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Probst and is a public service presentation of NBC. This is Charles Mountain speaking, and this is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.